are a podcast about comics, storytelling, and art. I'm Leslie, and this is Sloan.
Hello.
And today we have a special episode. Due to COVID-19, the comics festivals that were supposed to take place during May in Toronto and Vancouver were canceled, so we're doing this podcast episode, like, special for VanCav. And if you want more digital, you want to find more digital programming, you can check out #CanCav, which is a group effort promoting programming and events from comic festivals across Canada.
Yes.
And today we're joined by Matt Fraction. He's a writer.
I'm sorry. Now people know I.
Hi, Matt.
I'm sorry. I blew it.
No, it's cool. His notable works include his run on Hawkeye for Marvel and the Image comic Sex Criminals, and a personal favorite of ours, Casanova.
Yeah.
So hi, welcome, Matt.
Welcome.
Hi. How are y'all doing?
Doing good. Not working on many comics, but writing a book.
All right.
Leslie, what are you working on?
I'm finishing up like a short story. So I think that's why I have like such bad eye strain. Like my eye feels like it's going to come out of my head, but
yeah.
Other than that, doing pretty good.
Yes. Yeah. Quarantine, you know, quarantine brain.
But, I feel like I'm, you know, I have a host of mental health issues, and one of which is being clinically anxious. And I feel I've been waiting for this like my entire life. Like, I'm actually kind of finally I can put my shoulders down and stop worrying when the global quarantine is going to happen.
It's here and it's fine.
Reaction to have, but I do have some sense of like, finally, I knew this was going to happen.
I have I would say pretty bad social anxiety. So I remember when we were trying to plan to go to like all the comics festivals, I was like, maybe we won't go like because of all of this.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it kind of happened that way. Like, I know for a while we were trying not to, but I don't know. It's like a weird.
No. Municipally ordered plan canceling is kind of my personal purge. So like. Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, I can't do it. Can't do errands. I can't do, can't pay my bills. It's just, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty sick.
But yeah, we're very excited to talk to you, Matt. We read the first two Novembers, but we'll probably just talk about the first one since
the second one comes out. I haven't, did you get a physical copy or just a digital one?
Just digital, yeah.
Okay. All right, 'cause apparently, like it was one of the, apparently a physical copy made it to Image before queue time started.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But it's printed in China. So like, I don't know when or where it is or if.
Right.
So I know it's coming at some point, but like I've yet to see one in the wild. So.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, Leslie, your Snot Girls have been like in a warehouse for a while, right?
Yeah, I got my comp copies, but yeah, they're like,
that's good.
I think they're releasing, they're going to start shipping stuff in May.
Yeah.
End of May.
There was a batch of solicit stuff that went out today. Like, so yeah, I think it's going to kick back up over the summer.
Okay. Cool. Nice. Well, yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about November? We really enjoyed it. And
thanks.
Yeah, that's,
I'd love to hear about it. I was, let's see. Yeah, I wanted to, after working with David on Hawkeye, I was really intrigued to do a project that was deeply committed to some notion of formalism. In a way that even like something like Sex Criminal, which is all done on like an 8-grid, isn't, you know, like, the OCD part of my brain is driven crazy by books like Watchmen, where like there is a formalism to it, but like it's obsessed with clocks and 12 issues, but it's 9 panel pages. And why aren't the page count multiples of 12? Those are where my thoughts go. They're not even the same page count issue to issue. It drives me nuts. So I want to steer into that skid. And to like do that, that's a that's a crazy trip to take, and you have to kind of find like zealots as much as collaborators, you know. Elsa and I are pals and have been trying to find a thing to work with and a thing to do together. And she is completely fearless. I don't know if you know her origin story, but like it's insane and wonderful. And when I started to kind of muddle through my half thoughts about it, she was like, all right, I'm in, let's go. I'm like, okay, great. Let's, you know, and then you find people like Hollingsworth and Kurt Ankeny and even Ryan Hughes, who does the book, Ryan Hughes especially, is like, oh, great, I get this. I see exactly the kind of crazy planet you're on. you get a whole team. And that's really just that's the cornerstone of a cult right there. So yeah, it kind of came from wanting to do a really rigidly formal story. And I think between, I also kind of wanted to do something without jokes, you know, because I mean, like, I guess arguably Jimmy Olsen is the first thing I've done that's just straight, like, and there's still structure there though, but like, I don't know, I wanted to do something that was different than everything else I was doing, and kind of started to had these story fragments and started to find ways that they could all connect. And then I realized that was what the formalism was there for, right? To provide this kind of superstructure that would allow these otherwise random characters and events to kind of all intersect and start to kind of build it from this weird, you know, the notebook I have for it. It looks like John Doe's notebook from Seven. but somehow it out comes these beautiful books. Once I get out of the way and the art team takes over, it's great.
Nice. And so was this like, something that like story wise that you collaborated on with Elsa, or did you kind of have the story in mind and like presented it to her?
I kind of had the story and presented like the broad strokes of it, you know. I always kind of know the broad strokes. My go-to metaphor is, you know, if we're going to drive across the country without a GPS, like we're just going to draw the map, and let's say we're going to, you know, I'm in Oregon. Let's say we want to drive to Florida. In a couple of days, if we don't cross the Mississippi, we did something wrong, you know? So like, you know, I kind of gave her that portrait of how they would all connect together. And even then, in the writing of it, it kind of, you know, when I was writing the first one, I realized it really, there needed to be this fourth character present. And that was going to grow the shape and change the shape. And then once that fourth character showed up, I was like, oh, there really then needs to be a fourth book. And it's the difference between a story stopping and a story ending. And, you know, there's still room to grow and evolve as we went. And then once Elsa designed the characters, I was writing to them, you know, I could write more, the physicality she gave them. And I knew, you know, it's like Elsa like trained as an actress. So she responds as an artist really great to like undrawable emotional state kind of notes in the script. Right. It's impossible to conceive of without her storytelling. But like the actual plot more or less fell out of me, and you know, all of the other storytelling is her and Matt and Kurt, you know?
Right. Yeah. I guess I'm just interested in like your process and like excavating like a story and on these characters, like from the ground up. Like, are you a discovery writer? Do you like to work in outlines? Do scenes come to you first, or like, you know, that kind of thing?
Every project is a little different. Sometimes it's a character, you know. Jimmy Olsen was the character. I had the take on the character and kind of from there. This was more about the shape of the project than the content. And then it, you know, kind of it started from the outside and worked in. I don't know. It all changes. I do not, my outlines are handwritten and at best resemble a shopping list. just because I hate writing about what I want to write about, you know, I get bored. I get bored really easy. And if I've already discovered everything in the outline, it's not going to be any fun to write. So,
right.
Yeah, no, I tend to treat my notebook like an artist treats a sketchbook. There's lots of bad drafts and doodles in there, and build towards enough of a skeleton that I feel like, all right, now we can get in the car and drive to Florida. And I know you know, if we don't cross the Mississippi in 2 days, we've done something wrong.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So how does that work in like a book like November? Because I feel like this book is really structured, but like unstructured. So I feel like it's also, I feel like everyone kind of has to like run a really tight ship in terms of like what goes on in each page.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is a, it's a level to commit. Part of like committing to the gag was like, there are going to be rules we can't break once we commit. Mm-hmm. And that makes me uncomfortable because I have to an uncomfortable degree, break it out, break the paneling out. You know, I have to, there's an inner tempo that it follows. There's all these rules that we're agreeing to, and it's going to mean on another project, this would be a thing you would do. But because we are agreeing to do this, it means I'm going to say this has to be colored like this right now, right? And kind of working through what that meant. It's a weird way to work, but hopefully it doesn't look weird. Or I mean, hopefully it looks weird, but like hopefully it doesn't look, you know, like capers in a chocolate pudding or something. But like, so it was just kind of committing to all of us. Let's see what happens when we work this way. And you know, the flip side is now Elsa and I are talking about doing something as a follow-up that is completely the opposite, you know? The last thing I want to do is write another goddamn grid right now, let alone for her. I think she wants to do is draw one, so. I forgot the question.
Just like...
It's been so long since I've spoken to people, I'm sorry.
I was kind of wondering like how much control do you have over that? Or like other than like the structure?
In this case, more than I'm actually comfortable with, but like,
okay.
The best parts of Hawkeye were written what's called Marvel style or plot style. Mm-hmm. But even that betrays the intricacy of it. But like, yeah, no, I'm never going to outright David's hand. I'm never going to outright Ba's hand or Moon or anybody that I've worked with. I'm never going to outright Elsa. So get out of the way. Right. I try not to, but again, sometimes in the spirit of these things, you know, certain rules have to apply. It was a weird set of tools I'm not used to using. I'm glad that I did it. I don't know if I'm going to do it again, but I sure learned a lot, and I can exhale when it's done because the OCD part of my brain is going to be like, oh, finally, okay. That's formalism, goddammit.
You're like, done with formalism.
Done and dusted.
So what was your process with choosing where to like cut these graphic novellas up? Like, why not just do a whole book? Why was it important to kind of dice them up in the
book? Yeah, it was originally planned as a limited serial. Mm-hmm. And then Image had success with this format and presented it to us as this idea. Like, what if it was like this? And we kind of rejiggered it and thought about it and kind of, oh yeah, that could work. And it sort of changed, you know? It still follows what would have, and it's not like it has a three-act structure, but I mean, it kind of does. Everything has a beginning, middle, and end, right? So everything kind of has a three-act structure. It still roughly follows that, you know, what would constitute the end of the beginning is the end of the first volume. What would constitute the second act is kind of the second and third volumes, and then the kind of resolution is the fourth. So like the general shape remained intact. It just took some reconfiguring. And I had the last page of the third volume, all four characters in the same room at the same time for the first time. And like, I knew we were heading to that. I knew that was the beginning of the end. And you know, then we see through different perspectives how they all ended up there. Right. And even doubling back and showing a scene from two different POVs and once those tools kind of start to accrue and you know just what a narrative shape is and like, well, I know this, I want to tell a story about somebody who is like this and this thing happens and it leaves them like this on the other side. Like then you kind of just start to, like the fun thing about like writing Jimmy Olsen and doing all the fake kind of short stories is like, I don't have to write any boring scenes.
Right.
Right. It's all killer, no filler. I don't have to, I write until I get bored and then done. All right. Next scene. Like, I'll just say, and then he drove home and had lunch and woke up the next morning and this thing happened. And that's fine because, you know, that's the rules of that book. But so there's no messy narrative coherence that needs to be obeyed. I can just railroad over that shit. So this is very simple. Like this is the chapter where blank happens. And then I kind of could put that in a skeletal shape and start to write around it and trust too that just everybody is smarter than me. And if I can figure it out, I can surely understand where we're at. And then I realized what a weird misstep it maybe was to start a 4-volume series of graphic novellas where the lead character is in an alcoholic fugue state. But, you know, I've never been in the business to be successful. So why start now?
Yeah, that's like another interesting point is like you're saying, you could cut really fast in Jimmy Olsen. And I feel like this is also, like you're saying, paced very quickly. Do you like approach your story that way when you're scripting or discovery writing or whatever? Or do you cut and par down after you've kind of laid everything out?
I guess a little bit of both. And because like each of the chapters are all 12 pages. And I feel like I've got a pretty good sense of what you can accomplish in 12 pages. Mm-hmm. And you can accomplish a lot, right? Or you can accomplish very little, depending on sort of how close the camera is to everything, right? How deep a dive you go. Like one of the chapters coming up is about, like it happens, and about the time it would take you to read it is about the time it took to happen. Because that was exactly what it needed to be. And then there's another one where clearly this is an hours long experience. Yeah, I think that's kind of part of the fun of dealing with this, and that these are four strangers that are all going to intersect. It's like you get to experience time through all the different perspectives, you know?
Yeah.
Including someone literally in a traumatic fugue state who can't tell the difference between the past and the present. And as the story goes, we will be able to tell. So yeah, it took a lot of, like, at one point I was going through the notebook the other day and I found a year ago, I left myself a note I don't even know if I dated it, but the note was something like, I don't know if all these stories, one story, or I'm just trying to fit all these things into one thing it doesn't go into. Right. But yeah, it sort of, and if it didn't, there's a lot of stuff that went away, right? There were ideas or notions that went away, especially once it became, all right, I've got 4 12-page chapters with each of these characters and then these kind of bonus intro, outro sections per book that like determined tempo and pace and everything with what I knew had to happen from where we start and where we end. And then you kind of fill in the middle, right?
So how do you, I guess, how do you know, like, when how can you tell when something is like bad or not working or not going to work, or when it's just your own anxiety that's
the best thing I ever wrote is whatever I just finished, and the worst thing I ever wrote is whatever just came out. I don't mean to sound self-deprecating it is a thing that I fucking struggle with on a daily basis about literally everything. It took me years to figure out how to go to conventions without wanting to jump out of my own skin, you know? If you could see my feet in a convention, I am making diehard fists with my toes having conversations, because people are being very kind and very generous and lovely, and I don't know how to handle that. So I don't know, but I know the sound of the thing in my head, and I know what I can do to get it out of my head. That is different from quality. That is whatever the compulsion to write in the first place is, get the thing that is in the head out of the head. And I can do that. All I do is look at back. It's been awful with November. I've spent more time with November than like any other fucking thing I've ever written, because it's so... I have to remember, like, I call back, okay, this is book 2, chapter 2 or chapter 4, you know, page 5, panel 6 happens here. There's a whole you know, we see, oh, there's a whole page of Dee's life that we see in random panels before we actually see it in volume three. And then we reprint them all in their proper sequence. So there's a lot of reference. So I've spent a lot of time with November, which is agony. I'm the worst. I never look at the stuff after it's published, like if I can avoid it. So, so it's all very awkward and uncomfortable to me. I'm working. I work hard to like count my blessings and thank my lucky stars. And I always feel like Wile E. Coyote. Like I just ran off the cliff, and as long as I like don't look down, I won't fall.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I look down, physics will catch up to me. So.
So was there like any pushback from like Elsa or anyone else on the project about like maybe like trying to fit all these things into one, like into a chapter, or was it just like?
No, everybody like trusted everybody. Like schedule has been the biggest issue, because you know, at one point Elsa hurt her arm, and at one point I got buried. So like there were a couple of hiccups in the development of two and the sort. But it was really just about keeping schedule together. I think Matt is content. I mean, look, after you've told a guy, okay, so color this how dogs see color, like. Like I think Matt is completely intent to let me, you know, give me enough rope to hang myself. And Elsa, bless her heart, is too kind to say any difference. So, you know, everyone is trusting everyone else to do their part, and we'll see if it works at the end. I think, I think it is such an incredible looking book.
Yeah, for sure.
The three of them, if I can get out of my own way and just look at it objectively, like it is such a stunning piece of work, and that the three of them work together so beautifully. And then you find stuff like Kurt. I mean, first off, Kurt is a ridiculously gifted cartoonist in his own right. He just also has amazing handwriting. And that was what, and like I wanted to do a hand lettered book. Like I didn't want to use a font, and like Kurt was like, well, okay. you know, like he based one of the characters' handwriting is based on Mother Teresa's handwriting.
Wow.
Like that's different than just picking a font, you know? Yeah. There's a cartoonist's discipline to that stuff as well. That I'm amazed to see how they bring it together and bring it forward.
That's cool. Yeah, the writing is the lettering is very like luxe.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, even Kurt even fucking hand lettered the Indicia, right? Like, that's clearly a sign of someone having gone full Colonel Kurtz. Because when even the Indicia is lettered by hand, someone's gone up the river and not come back.
Yeah.
That person being. And in that scenario, Kurt is Willard coming to kill me.
Yeah, we really love the lettering. The only thing was like me and Lizzie were like, oh, we never really used cursive ever. Yeah. So we're like squinting so hard at the cursive. And it's not because it's badly written. It's beautifully written. It's just we're not used to it. So we're like, I'm like, it's a lost art. It's really sad.
Yeah, it's definitely like something you learn to read. Because I think after like when I got into the second volume, I was like, oh, okay, like, this is making a lot more sense to me, like on the second read or second experience with it, basically.
Right. Movies like real thick accents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sexy beastening or something. Like it's like that first 20 minutes, I'm kind of just going with it. Or Shakespeare. It takes a while for me to understand what people are saying. Like I can hear the words, but like it takes a minute for my brain to catch up and start to actually deliver the words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very intimate. It all feels like notes the characters are writing down in their own hand, like on the side.
Yeah.
Their narration, which is really cool. Yeah, a lot of stuff that I was going to ask you is now kind of moot point because it's like plot. It's like part of your plot. It's part of your design. but I guess when approaching something like this, which is like you're saying, very formalist, and it also has like a lot of like traditional, like gritty noir like tropes and stuff. Like, how do you avoid or embrace those? Like, when and where do you do that, and why? Like, when is it important to like lean into a certain genre trait, and when do you like push back against it?
Do you know James Ellroy's definition of noir?
Mm-mm.
It's two words: you're fucked. And I think that's true from a certain point of view and a certain kind of noir. And like I had a moment in writing the fourth volume where in my notebook I wrote, like, I don't want this to be the downer ending that these could be on their own. Like, I want, by virtue of these stories being tied up together, to be something better than you're fucked. Like, I want the sum total of these people connecting with other people to mean, like, this is the thing that breaks you out of your fucked, right?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you just have to steer into the genre and what the genre demands. And, like, I'm not apologizing because I love it. But, like, mm-hmm. It's definitely clear that, like, for all of the hoity-toity fucking art school thinking about formalism and grids and patterns and numbers, like, at the end of the day, it's, like, dudes with guns stealing from other dudes and people... people getting tied up, like it ain't high art, right? Like Jonathan Franzen is losing no sleep over it, so it's not a I don't know. I'm more comfortable not trying to do, I don't know, I don't know, it is what it is, and that's the ride we're taking, so
yeah. I guess I that was like kind of way too general. I'm interested in what you personally like wanted from the genre, which you kind of answered, but also what you're like, nah, I'm not going to do that in this, or like.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because of where I started to write it and where I ended up, just internally, just emotionally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think I started it during a very bad time in my life.
Hmm.
And it was like throwing a football, and I don't know who's going to be there to catch it, but I know where I'm going to throw it, and I hope I'm there to catch it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it came from a very dark place, but it came from there because I needed to tell myself a story where people are what saved other people. So yeah, I think it came from a place of despair and wanting so badly for these women to escape it, and wanting to tell that story of escape, kind of, and the virtues of who they are, gave me the story I ultimately wanted to write.
Hmm.
You know, it's a long way to safe for any of them, and not all the characters make it out of the other side, but it was all. By design, sure, but a lot of my design is left open until it's showtime, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can drive through the skinny part of Texas or the fat part of Texas, they'll both take you east.
Hmm.
But like, I had no, to kind of add on to that, like, I had no interest in like telling a story where three women get killed by men, you know, like, mm-hmm. That is not that thing that I'm into. Mm-hmm. I did a re-release of the first graphic novel I ever wrote. And so I had to reread that for the first time in 18 fucking years, 19 years,
mm-hmm.
Which is weird to say. Choosing to like not special edition it, choosing to not change things,
mm-hmm.
Because it was dishonest, and you know, and I wrote this as a kind of in the afterword is like, there are things in here I would not write today, mm-hmm. And I know what the me of 2001 would say, which is, oh, these characters would talk. If today says find better characters,
mm-hmm.
But it felt dishonest to like pretend that, you know. Or anything but. So there was a deliberate choice of like, even if the definition of noir is you're fucked, like, that's not the story I guess I want to tell in the end.
Right.
So maybe it's not noir because they're not all fucked. A little fucked, half fucked.
Yeah, that's interesting. This feels like so not rigidly put together, but very like meticulously put together. So it's interesting that like it feels like your process feels not that kind of, but then you are very like
thoughtful.
You're like chaotic, kind of like vision, but like
vision come to prepared spirits, right? Like I talked over you. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
No, please. Yours was better.
it's interesting to see like my impression of the story and like how you might have put it together just from as an artist thinking of how this would be scripted. It feels very different from how you're like processing and developing the story, which is cool. Right. It's cool.
Yeah,
it's interesting. You know, who would have thought?
it was definitely a kind of like sweet and sour kind of experience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To have that sort of, I'm not entirely sure what's going to happen. I know she's going to get out of the trunk. I don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird when you're then saying, but it has to happen on a 12-page grid, and I got 3 pages to do it. And
yeah, that last
page will be a 12-panel page, and every third panel is going to have words, and none of the other ones. Like,
oh my God.
Okay. So it's not entirely chaotic.
No. Oh, that sounds nightmarish to write, but. Very fun to read.
Yes, it's really engrossing for sure.
I did it. Oh, I'm sorry. What was that?
It's really engrossing. That's what it was.
Yeah, thank you. I did a book called Odyssey with Christian Ward. That was a retelling of Homer's Odyssey, and Greek. It was written in a heroic and a dactylic hexameter, which is a kind of prosody. That took advantage of ancient Greek's long and short syllables. We don't have long and short syllables in English, but we have stresses. So stressed and unstressed syllables. So I applied that shape to English, and it was awful. And my wife swears she knew when I was writing Odyssey, because I would just be stomping around the house and screaming at myself all day long. Because you just want someone to say, I want to go to the bathroom, and you can't, because it's got to be...
So you have like a lot of self-imposed rules for different books.
Sometimes, yeah, absolutely. Sometimes.
Very masochistic of you.
Yeah. Clearly, so I'm working through some things.
Yes. So, do you do that like just for the challenge of it, or does this like serve
another purpose? The best thing anybody ever said about my work, I think it was one of those moments where like I had like five things happening at the same time or six, and they're like, none of it feels like it's by the same person. You know, like, that's the best. So yeah, part of it was just also like, I'm not like, my wife has amazing prosody, I do not. and I wanted to force myself to do a project where like I wrote pretty, right? I want to do a thing where I am forcing myself to consider the meter every single time, because it's so antithetical to how I tend to write dialogue and stuff. So like part of it was like, what is the thing I've never done before? And now I can say comfortably, and what is the thing I will never do again?
Very cool. Yeah, it's definitely interesting to see you like explore all these different, it's kind of like Oulipo-esque foundations that these stories are kind of like leaping from. It's very very interesting. How do you deal with like, go ahead.
No, I guess it's kind of half a thought. You keep going, and if the full thought comes to me, I'll pipe up.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess I kind of want to ask about what happens when these challenges kind of like overwhelm you. Like, obviously, like they can be frustrating. Do you ever find yourself like, how do you deal when you get blocked or, you know, have to like push on despite how you're feeling? Like, how do you deal with that?
Well, as part of the reason that I tend to have more than one thing going at once, and if fortune smiles upon me, then I can go where I have answers that day. And if I don't, I can let it cook until I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there are some benefits to be had and doing work for hire, one of which is doing it, it helps divorce you from preciousness, knowing that, hey, listen, the Batman train or the Spider-Man train is going to leave the station every 28 days. You can be on it or something else will. And having kids helped divorce me from preciousness, right? And there's this feeling of responsibility for with my collaborators. Like, hey, if I'm not writing and you're not drawing, and if you're not drawing, our book's not coming out, you're not getting paid. And that's my fault because I had to figure out how to fucking say, I need to go to the bathroom with prosody. So there's a lot of pressures that help divorce me of that. And it must be said too, like, hey, we went dark on sex criminals for longer than either of us expected. Because I didn't have it. And it's our ending. And I didn't want to come back if we didn't have an ending that was good.
Yeah.
And like, hey, you know what? Part of the benefit of not doing work for hire is if I don't have a good book right now, if I don't have a thing that like I'm confident and secure in that will eventually be a part of a evergreen kind of sales item, like I'm actually doing more harm dumping it out now because I will make more money for everyone involved in the long term. Let's just speak about this in pure capitalism, right? Capitalistic terms. Let's not even talk about creative. Like everyone's going to make more money if I write books that sell forever instead of if I write a book that has a 6-day sales cycle and is never thought of again.
Yeah.
So in the case of sex criminals, it was like, oh, hey, you know what? I don't have it yet. We need to chill for a while. I got to figure this out. And really find my way in and did. And now we're back and that's great. And then of course the world ended. So joke's on.
Leslie, do you want to ask some of your questions?
I kind of want to ask about like how the process has been for something like sex criminals, like just like how does that process going into sex criminals vary from November? Like obviously you have like they're different very different stories, so are they treated completely differently or is it kind of just like what is going on there?
We have more in common than it seems, but you know, it's sectional is the other book I do that's on a grid, right? Like mm-hmm. You know, Chip had never worked with another writer and so much of the book was humor, was jokes, and like so much of jokes are timing, and it's like I have to write this in a grid for the jokes to work. It's like there's nothing more unfunny than comics funny. So to actually write something funny, like without qualification, like okay, that's going to require certain things, right? But with November, it starts out and goes in. You know, the fiction novels was really starting in and going out, and that's kind of like in the back of I think 26 when we came back for our kind of last six issues, like I say, like, hey, I realized I didn't care about the criminals part of the title anymore. That's a good time to end your book called Sex Criminals. Like what I needed to realize over the time that we were dark is this is really the story of these two falling in love. And that's the story I wanted to tell. And so focus on that and the rest will take care of itself, right? And it has, at least to my satisfaction, as it feels just getting it out of my head. I'm literally writing the last script as we speak. It was what I was working on before I called, and it's like a heavy emotion. I've been writing a lot of endings in quarantine, which is very weird. But hopefully, I'm a little more equipped to handle it than like the last time this happened, when it sort of sent me spiraling into depression. But yeah. So it starts with the characters, and it starts with, you know, I know what the story is. I know where it's going to end, right? I know where this issue is going to end. You know, I know where, and then it kind of just fills in, and then it's really all about making Chip laugh.
I muted myself. Sorry.
This maybe should have been an indicator of that, but the arc where they were broken up, because they were broken up, I didn't write it in a grid, and it's the only parts of the book that aren't done on an 8-page on an 8-panel grid, which is some weird like self, like subconscious like expression of what the book really is, right? Like this is their story. When it's not their story, it's not the right book. So I don't know if anybody noticed that or cared, but. But it was a weird thing that mm-hmm. felt right. It didn't work until it was like, oh, right, it's not in the grid anymore. And then it, was, mm-hmm. then it came together. Or as much as anything, it came together.
That's interesting. It's very, like, rhythm-based for you, like, visually, like, your visual tempo.
Yeah, yeah. I know, and I came from a filmmaking and animation background, and, you know, mm-hmm. it's all editing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I remember doing a piece in, I think it was when I was at Columbia, where, like, everything was cut in multiples of 24 frames, right? Or maybe it was less than that. Maybe it was 20 frames. It's some multiple, like, because I would have to come where the action was that I was cutting on and then work backwards to where I could start. The piece had a weird timing, and you would feel it as you started to watch it innately. You just kind of sensed where the cuts were going to come. And then I fucked it all up at the end. it was jarring, and it had the effect I wanted it to have. It was otherwise a largely unremarkable piece of work, but that was noticeable to me. Cutting to a deliberate tempo and then screwing with it, the effect that has is potent. I think it's really important for jokes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So true. Honestly, I like reading November, I didn't actually realize that it was on a grid until like halfway through the first book, I think.
Great.
So I feel like it's kind of like, I feel like that kind of stuff is more hidden than it is when you're making it, obviously, because you're thinking about it a lot more. But
yeah, I think that kind of belies like how I feel like when it melts into the background like that, it's something. I think that's a good thing.
Your eyes
not, you know, like staggering through the mathematics of rhythm. It's just like flowing for you. So
yeah, I hate to see like a page and be like a grid, like you know, in the sense that I'm not actually like reading it, like not looking at the pictures, not looking at like the text or anything, and just being like, ew, like I don't want to read this. No, so
that's interesting.
Like someone's air guitaring a grid at you. They're like, check
yeah. They're like, look at it. I have like 10 drawings on here, and I'm like, I don't,
like waggling their eyebrows at you with their grid.
Yeah. So I think as like someone that sees that a lot and tends to be like turned off by it, it's really cool that it was able to blend in so well, at least mm-hmm. for me.
Yeah. It's something that I disagree with Frank Santoro about this. I haven't had the chance to like speak mm-hmm. with him about it, but like a lot of his writings about page composition and stuff revolves around not giving up the center. Mm-hmm. And I think giving up the center, I think center focal points stop your eye and are boring. Mm-hmm. I think that's why Euro comics look like they're these weird, spacey, frozen, like there's no, you know, like it's like so many of those European comics with that sensibility, which Frank will go through in all of his various different web incarnations and shows, like, look, they didn't give up mm-hmm. the center. All the center-based composition is absolutely right. I think it makes for a very staid, very boring composition. Whereas if you play with the thirds and you play with where your punches fall, and you play with that rhythm, mm-hmm. I mean, comics are built on a 1-2-1-2-3 kind of rhythm, like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that not just so you have the page, you have two pages, you have a flip, right? You've got everything kind of there's ghost metrics of rhythm just innate to the form, right? Mm-hmm. You're gonna flip on every odd page, right? Every odd page you're gonna have a turn, just because that's how math works. And that's also how printing signatures work, right? You're gonna every odd number page you're gonna flip, every right facing page gets flipped.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how do you build that into the actual storytelling? Mm-hmm. So like the first thing I'll do, like when I'm blocking a story out, is write the page numbers, but then I'll draw where the signatures are, so I know where the flips are, so I can write to the page flips. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason that like double page spreads are so popular with writers at Marvel and DC right now is because they can control the ad breaks better if they're writing in double page spreads.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to write a big dramatic scene and then like flip a page to have a Snickers bar ad, right? it's like forcing a card in a magic trick or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we're not going to give up the center, which means we're going to have an asymmetrical kind of page shape, an asymmetrical kind of format. And then you've got this thing where every other thing is a flip, and like, okay, what does that look like? And what does that suggest then for the page itself? And what does that suggest for the sequence of panels? And like, you know, it becomes this endless chasing of that rhythm and that pattern. And then once that in the DNA, it can grow wherever it needs to grow and be whatever it needs to be. And hopefully you don't notice it, you don't see it, you don't feel it. And it just kind of works gently and guides the thing. And when you're lost, it can help guide me, right? When I get lost, I can, like, shit, I don't know what to do here. Like, I can go back to those kind of first principles and find, because it always comes from a place of, like, what the book's about, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to just, I'm doing this in 9-panel grid because it's Jimmy Olsen. Doesn't make sense. But to do it in a 12-panel grid because like it's that is a different thing. And once I start to go back to those first principles, the answers to whatever I'm stuck on will kind of present themselves eventually.
Seems very methodical.
It doesn't feel like it. Fuck, I would imagine it to you. It's like a thing you have to relearn every single time. But thank you.
Maybe that speaks to how like how in control you are, that this feels like freeing this process.
It's like, I remember when, you know, back when I was on Twitter, when people would complain about it, I always felt that like that character limit was a shape and it suggested the kind of writing and communication you could do, right?
Yeah.
Like it's 140 character. It's not a 140 character limit. It's like a 140 character shape. Like it's the, it is the vessel with the, that you can like, oh, I had 32 ounces of Mountain Dew. Why didn't it fit this Dixie cup? Like, well, because it's a Dixie cup, right? So yeah, no, I like shapes are reassuring because I get lost and I don't know what's going to happen, but I have the shape to fall back on, and I have the shape, so then I can start to go back to how I got there in the first place.
I feel like when you put it like that, it makes more sense to me somehow, just because I get really annoyed when people have like 100 tweet threads of something they're talking about.
Yes, yeah.
And like they somehow can't boil it down to like, I don't know, maximum like 2 or 3.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing here?
Also, when did we become so lazy that the idea of clicking to like a blog or something else became just, I can't click another link. I can't possibly leave Twitter to read the rest of your thoughts.
Yeah.
I don't miss it at all.
Yeah. You've made a wise choice. I'm kind of interested in how you develop these characters. They're all women. Two of them are like women of color. And I feel like right now making characters like of a marginalized background or whatever is just something that everyone is either like, I mean, not that I'm questioning like the genuineness of it, but everyone's kind of like, well, why wouldn't you just make this character, you know, a woman or black or disabled? Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. But I'm interested in why you chose these specific identities and aspects for them.
Well, I mean, I needed, there are a few reasons. One, to challenge myself, to step out of my comfort zone. Two, because I needed to tell a story about people on the margins, right? And I needed to tell a story about people who could be ignored and disregarded and written off as a matter of just everyday existence, right? So it kind of came from there, and like and then once it became clear, like, no, this isn't about, this is about three women, that in kind of informed everything, right? But what happens when you bring when you bring women into this very traditionally male world of noir, right? And noir tropes and stuff, but it's not it's not rejecting that, like, okay, well, you have to be the gun mall and you have to, you know, like it's they are all deeply, well, not deeply, the two of them are deeply flawed, one of them is pretty fucking human, and like it's that just became again like the shape to write into, and, you know, to write this kind of you know, the Kay, the cop, knows what's going on and no one believes her because you know, and it's like, oh, that's how that happens. That happens like that. I bet every day, all the time, in all things, about everything. So how could all of this be happening in a world? It's like, well, you populate that world with women as well as men, and those men who don't believe women and don't listen to women and don't respect women, and their potency as whistleblowers and observers. You know, the flip side is, hey, no one pays attention to D, so D sees everything. Because no one, you know, no one pays attention to her. So yeah, it becomes a chance to further the theme and extend the shape and make myself uncomfortable and try to write stories and characters I've never written before. And to hopefully in that process, like, expand my own humanity and empathy a little bit and understanding a little bit.
How do you go about like researching writing characters that you're not necessarily comfortable with? Or is there just like, is it just something you already had in your head?
I think they sort of show up, which I don't mean to sound magical realist about it, but like they just kind of show up and it feels right. It feels like a fit. And if it's a, one of the like real like blessings is kind of the only word for it, as much as I don't like to say it, of writing sex criminals has been how much of a opportunity to grow my own complacent sense of empathy as I explore and create these characters with sexualities different than mine. It's uncomfortable and it's difficult. Not the empathy part, but like the learning part, right? The shame that comes with it, right? The embarrassment and the guilt and all that stuff that serves no one, but me. So getting through that and then digging into writing these people as people and people who are in having just writing them as people, but doing as much research as I can to, in terms of what those people can expect on a daily basis, that perhaps white dudes that look like me don't have to expect. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I appreciated that because I like the characters a lot, and there's a lot of like very specific, intimate details that you get into that are, I don't know, I just feel like a lot of comics I read nowadays, even if they do have like a character of color, a woman or someone who has a disability, it's just like a surface detail, and it's not actually brought into play with the story or their character's arc or whatever.
Yeah.
So I did this was actually had like a material effect with the story. So that was, yeah.
I think it definitely, I mean, yeah, it when I figured out it was about these three women, the whole thing showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of knew what it was, and I knew that I could do it, and I knew that I wanted to do it. So, and all that was predicated on very much on who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like, and she's a lesbian. It was, and she's an alcoholic that has quietly gone back out of sobriety and is hiding it from her estranged wife, who she hides from at work drinking, and I can write that. I can write that feeling,
I feel like even though a lot of it there's like a lot of internal dialogue monologue, I feel like you still learn so much about the characters like as you read it, which is interesting because as Sloan said, I feel like a lot of people just present it really surface and they're like, I did this thing, like look at it. But these characters are much more like they're revealing things to you slowly as you get to know them, which I enjoyed.
Thank you very much. I've tried to read Game of Thrones and I haven't been successful. But at one point there was like one of the women was walking somewhere and considering the way her own pendulous breasts felt beneath her sackcloth. And I was like, I bet no woman has ever thought about the way their pendulous breasts.
That's very real. No,
it's not just all the time.
Every day.
They knock against
me. I knew it.
It's very authentic.
Yeah, it was just that sort of like, I bet the only... Yeah, it just like, I don't know, man. I don't think about my balls all that much. Like,
thought about being his man with balls.
Being a ball hopper, I understood as I sat my balls down on a chair, followed by the rest of me. I don't know. And it's also like, I don't want to not tell stories that happen to people whose bodies and lived experiences are different than my own.
Yeah.
But I also don't want to purport to speak with any, all I know are those characters, right? All I can imagine is that life. Specifically, that specific person. That is the sum total of what I can do. And I hope if you get you guys both know this as much as this is an insane way to make a living and an insane thing to do for, it's like, it does, there's a reason so many people in this business go crazy. Like, to live with these voices and these people in your head for so long, like, it has to be worth it. It's got to be worth spending that time and that energy on. So, and like the times that I haven't been, it makes me feel like garbage because work feels like waiting in open sewage every day.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate you saying that because I feel like it's just like that aspect of being a writer, an artist, and taking the time to like empathize with your character as part of your craft is not as common as it should be. I don't know if it's out of like laziness or fear or just like general indifference, but I think that's super crucial. Don't just make it like, okay, I'm only going to write what I know and what I've experienced, but it's going to be through the visage of like a Black character or disabled character. Like, no, just take the time and read, talk to people, do some research, like and think about it.
Listen, I over these past four nightmarish fucking years, I have listened a lot and hope that it has made me a better person. I'm a better writer too, but I'll settle for person. you know, that like, hey, it's a bummer for me. You know who it's a bigger bummer for? People who aren't white dudes.
Yeah.
Hey, big fucking learning moment.
Totally.
I mean, I definitely think that a lot of people are afraid of changing their story. Like, they kind of have like the bones of it, and then like when they start getting into it more, it's like it gets to be too much. You kind of have to like push past that a little bit. So I feel like there's always like more work to be done.
Yeah, exactly. And the degree, yes, there absolutely. I pretend I said that first. No, you said it first. You took that. I know it's work to be done, and it can be uncomfortable work. And white people don't like discomfort. If I've learned one thing about white entitlement these last 4 years, white people don't like being inconvenienced.
Yeah. They like They're to like, have like,
what is this?
They want like a cookie and that's it. They don't want like,
They don't want to make the cookie. They want you to make them a cookie.
And they can like say it's really good.
They'll buy the cookie. Yeah. I saw somebody say that about like the protests, the reopen the everything protests. Like, they don't want to go back to their jobs giving haircuts. They don't have jobs giving haircuts. They want you to go back to your job and give them a haircut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Ugh. Anyway,
we're coming up on an hour. Do you have any like last questions?
Last words.
Last words. R.I.P. Otherwise, I was kind of going to ask like a big, like a
overarching,
like a question. Yeah, kind of like quarantines, like a, like, what is it like right now? You're creating work in this, you know, state of things. Like, how is this like affecting you as an artist and a storyteller? Like, what is this doing for you? Is it like inhibiting you, or are you finding yourself more grounded?
I don't know if I have the optics on some of that yet. I think it'll be in a year or two when these things are all done and out. I know it's affecting me. I wrote the last Jim Yulson issue. It was like the first quarantino script. and or this is the last two, rather, it was 11 and 12, and like realized it was Blazing Saddles, or at least as close to Blazing Saddles as I'm gonna get. So like I steered into it, and it felt therapeutic. It's literally a pie fight happens. And just this, like, you know, at the end of Blazing Saddles, everyone's crashing through the right, all the different movie sets, and the cowboys are fighting each other on the Busby Berkeley musical stage, and it's just like that chaos. And it clearly was making me feel good to write. Like, I was laughing. It was funny. So yeah, absolutely. I don't know. We'll have to, you know, a couple of years, maybe a better idea of it. Realistically, just moment to moment, day to day, which is kind of how anybody maybe has to live right now.
Yeah.
It keeps my shit together for good or for ill. A lot of my sense of self-worth is tied up into my productivity. And I know that's not healthy, but it is true. So it is keeping me sane by producing shit every day. And I got two kids, and being sane is real important, right? My joke is always like, you know, how's quarantine going? I'm like, oh, that's fine. I sat everybody down and we watched The Shining the first week, and everybody understands what the rules are now. It's like the shitty joke. No, I feel, anything I can do to keep my shit together, which in this instance is, hey, produce pages, do work. I don't know when they're coming out. I don't know when you're going to see them. I don't know when they're getting printed. I don't know who's going to fucking sell them, but I'm right there.
Yeah.
And they will be sitting on a server somewhere forever if need be. And that helps keep it together for when I go upstairs and deal with these two incredibly inquisitive little people who have just as many questions as the rest of us that are just as valid, none of which have answers. You remember The Simpsons, where
I've heard of it.
Have you heard of The Simpsons? You guys, that's the in quarantine, there's an amazing show. It's called The Simpsons.
It's the right unheard of.
Bart
wakes Homer up.
Bart wakes Homer up. He's like, Dad, I thought the boogeyman is under my bed. I'm like, And then they go and they wake up Lisa. Dad, what's wrong? And Homer goes, I don't want to disturb you, but there's boogeyman or men in the house. Like, I feel like that is the razor's edge of truth that I walk at any given moment. I'm just banging away. And it's weird. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead, Matt.
I just recognize, too, that I am writing a lot of endings, which is scary to me emotionally, let alone that it is endings being written now. So there's something about facing these. Literally, the first line of the last issue of Sex Criminals is like, I wasn't ready for this to be over.
Yeah.
Right? Like, hey, guys, it's me writing that, not the character saying that. It's me. Like, I'm like, okay, just process it all, man. Just get it, process it all on the page and you know, let your shrink sort it out in a couple of years.
Yeah. It's interesting to see, like, how, like, your state of mind affects like the beginnings and ends of things that you're working on.
How are you? And you both talk about what you were working on. How are you finding it? The work affected?
Definitely like a little less productive than I should be. But other than that, I feel like it's relatively the same mentally. I think it's a bit taxing and it's hard to like pinpoint that other than like a general anxiety and like ennui, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm pretty paranoid because I can go to the hospital just from like inhaling passing smoke. So I'm pretty scared. But it's been pretty motivating because I'm like, okay, I need to write my like horny alien court intrigue arranged marriage with men. novel like now before I die. So
yeah, I often think about that like a little bit more than I should probably. Like I'm like, what was gonna happen if I die? Like is the last thing I make gonna be like the stupid thing that I wrote or like a kind of like poignant yet stupid thing I wrote?
Like, yeah.
It's impossible to know.
I'm like cleaning up the desktop just in case.
That's always been our direction to the artists that have done XXX variant covers for Sex Criminals. Please imagine that this is the last thing you complete in your workspace and your family finds it and they're so upset you receive no burial.
Just like no acknowledgement.
Oh man.
They
just put you dead in front of your like tablet at the computer. They're like, we're not even gonna bother toting you out of here.
Yeah, just throw everything in the trash.
That's the Big Lebowski, where you know, colors on the scribbles on the impression on the notepad. Yeah.
It's like that naked guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh man.
What did you dad drawing? Oh Jesus.
Like, no. Well, Leslie,
I do know this. I know, though, on the other side of this, and there will be another side, comics will be back. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they're gonna look like. I don't know where they're going to be sold.
Yeah.
It's not going away. And I know people will be back, and people are going to be dying for new stories. Mm-hmm. And are absolutely aching for, like, new imagination, like, new visions, new journeys, new experiences, new trips that they can take, like, not escape. Like people are gonna be aching for this shit when we're on the other side, and I think we should all pretend that we're gonna be ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I'm excited because I feel like I like writing like sci-fi a lot, and right now I feel like none of like the futurists in the genre. Yeah. I have like any idea how to approach like the future now. Like I feel like we've lived through so many weird, just like embarrassing apocalyptic events and like accidental mistakes that it's just like, oh, like anything they imagine or have been imagining has like paled in comparison to just like what has actually been lived up to this point. So yeah. I'm excited to just like this, like these contemporary writers, like I don't know how they're gonna.
Yeah, maybe the last like major nodal point in human history that affected at least the Western world, the North American world, part of the world was 9/11, right? And that was the thing that like even William Gibson started to write about the past after 9/11, right? Like mm-hmm. like that's telling. When hey, the futurist guy is writing about 1998 and 2004. That's really fucking says something about where we're at.
Yeah, he's like, forget this, I'm going back.
Actually, played during the Civil War. It's my badge of your computer. You're welcome.
Oh, do you want to tell us like maybe what you're reading or watching right now that you really like?
Sure. I'm devouring every book I've been given like the last 10 Christmases.
A backlog.
I've literally read like 50 books since quarantine started. I'm reading a book called A Cast of Killers right now, which is a story so crazy and so good, I don't want to tell you any of it for fear of spoiling even the smallest detail, all of which is its own get the fuck out of here kind of moment. It was written, last name, Kirkpatrick wrote that. I read Sam Watson's The Long Goodbye The Big Goodbye about the making of Chinatown, in which Roman Polanski is the second worst character in the book, which is really saying something. That was an incredible read. I'm reading Sean Levy's The Castle on Sunset about the history of Chateau Marmont.
Ooh.
I read a lot. And I sort of like the new Preston Sturges biography. So I'm looking forward to that. Fiction wise, I'm really, really loving the work of Charles Yu right now, who wrote Interior Chinatown. It's his most recent work, How to Survive a Science Fictional Universe. That's really astonishing short stories. There was one in New Yorker, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago that you can probably find for free still. And watching, it's funny, the kind of support that people you love kind of spending I did, both to like kind of like Arrow Video-esque, you know, sort of like people keeping really obscure, you know, movies in print. So I have a stack of garbage movies to watch that I've yet to crack. I'm very excited about. And I just saw, what's it called? Iron Fists and Kung Fu Kicks, maybe, something like that, on Netflix. It's a documentary by the guys that did Electric Boogaloo.
Okay.
The documentary of Canon Films. If you've never seen that, first off. First off, fuck Tiger King. Go watch that. And then, yeah, so now they did kind of a movie about the kind of the history of the Kung Fu film as a global phenomenon. So that was a lot of fun to watch. But having watched it now, I want to go and, you know, dig up all my Shaw Brothers movies and watch those. So nice. probably King Boxer, I think. The next time I sit down to watch something, that would be King Boxer.
Nice.
You know, highbrow. Always highbrow. Criterion Channel. I haven't watched it yet. I'm very excited that it's there, though. Awesome. How about you? Give me, what are you guys into? What's going on?
Ooh. What have you been watching or reading, Leslie?
I'm gonna
start. I'm gonna let you answer the question by rephrasing it for Leslie.
Terrific. You can understand what he just asked.
I just watched, I was telling Sloan about this earlier, but I watched this Australian reality show called like Instant Hotel. I think it's about like luxury Airbnbs, and it's like the whitest thing I've ever seen like in a while, like other than Tiger King, obviously. But you know, this is a little bit more like insidious because it's not as obvious. And I was telling Sloan about this like crazy part where like they brought out these like really rich white people that basically own a rainforest, brought out these Aboriginal and like they were like, this is so beautiful and cultural, and they're like dancing for like their dinner entertainment, and then like they're like, okay, goodbye. Like, this is just like your entertainment and not like anything else. Like, it was a lot. But yeah, I've just been watching a lot of really dumb reality TV shows. I don't know. I'm sure I'll get back into it.
Yeah, no judgment. This is no. No, believe me, this is great.
Yes, you have to be tender with yourself right now and just.
That's true.
Never watch trash.
Yeah, baby. Yeah,
when I was in Australia, I discovered like I love cops, or you know, the Canadian version of cops is Mounties.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Great, because it's cops but with Mounties.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, he's a real bad guy. He's got out there. Oh, he's probably eating a lot of methamphetamine, and he's rough news. He's a real tough character. So we're gonna bring him down, and we're gonna make sure he. And once an episode on Mounties, they stick a dog on somebody. That's how you know. That's the difference between cops and Mounties. But there's the Australian equivalent is like a border. It's like customs at the airport in Sydney, and it's all stories about people trying to get away with shit in customs, and it was riveting.
Yes. Yeah. My mom's been watching those nonstop, but like, I think it's like Border Patrol. So it's like the Mexican American border.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she loves it. And every time they find cocaine, the TV goes, cocaina, cocaina, cocaina. Like, echo. Nice. Yeah. So I hear that like every 2 minutes. Cocaina.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't think of what I've been watching. Nothing great. I have been reading a really good book that has been, it's like, I don't know if you know Blake Butler at all.
Yeah.
You know Blake Butler? Oh, okay, I'm reading 300 Million, which is very freaky. It's about like this like Mansonoid cult killer dude, and his like life's purpose is to kill every person in America.
Mm-hmm.
And he does this and like all the bodies pile up, and he does this like through other people. It's very fun. It's really, really long, and it's like, I don't know. I'm kind of like addicted to this book. I've never like wanted to read every single word like so carefully before. And I don't know why. It's like very hypnotic and it's very hard to describe, but that's the premise. Cool. But yeah, I've been reading that for like a couple months now. He's really an interesting writer. It's very relevant right now.
Yeah. Wow.
True.
I'm gonna check the shit out of that.
Yeah, it's dope. What did I? And then I guess the last thing I watched was like Extraction.
Oh yeah, the Chris Hemsworth movie.
Yeah. I did watch that. Pretty fun, but they made him too like feely. And it's not a feely movie. Like they tried to make him care about some like little kid that he was supposed to rescue, and it just didn't work. I don't know why. I think it was just because Because, like, I can buy into that. Like, you know, like the Jason Statham thing where he's like, my package is this little Chinese girl. And wait, I like her now. Like, oh yeah, I was like, okay, yeah, of course. But this is like, I was like, nah, I don't think he cares that much.
I feel like it's like the military thing, isn't it? Like, it kind of plays into it where you're like, I don't know if I buy it.
Yeah. Like, yeah. There's some like, decent
action. Also, it gets in the way. Like, you don't watch those movies because you want to see adult child bonding.
Yeah.
Right? That's Amy John Wick was going to be badass. They fucking killed the dog in the trailer.
Yeah.
Like, they're getting this shit out of the way, you guys. The dog dies.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. And they have to remind you once a movie, they killed my dog. That's why the
started. All the characters are like, for a dog? You did this for a dog?
But the minute he says it, the entire audience is like, well, you do have a point. John Wick, you have a point.
Yeah.
He's right. He's right to do that. It's really good.
Everything he does, he's blameless.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh yeah, the other thing I was watching recently is Run. It's on like HBO.
Yeah, the Phoebe Waller-Bridge's new show, right?
Yeah, with like Merritt Weaver and Domhnall Gleeson.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it's very cute. They're like a college couple, like grew apart over like what, 2 decades or something, but they made a pact that they'd like meet up if either one of them ever texted Run to the other, and they take like a long train ride. So they do it, and they have to like deal with who they are now, which is like kind of the same but kind of not. So it's very fun. Cool. A very nasty rom-com. But yeah, that's what we've been watching. That's what we've been reading.
All right, everyone has their homework. Come back in a week and they'll be tested.
Yes. But yeah, thank you, Matt, for coming on and talking to us. This was really nice.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Awesome to get into your process. And yeah.
Yeah, everyone go read November and check it out when it's out.
And when you're out again, also, is all. You know what? I know that there's digital copies that exist. Okay, look, there's a digital copy. I don't want to try to live your life. You should be able to buy what you want, the format you want it. That's cool. I get it. But like, we fucking killed ourselves on the physical thing. Like, it's the most beautiful book. Please, please check out the actual physical book itself. Mm. It's so good.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful book, and I'm sure it's even more beautiful in person. Love to see but this is really cool, really enlightening, very interesting.
Thank you so much. Thank you for like going fucking yard on the book too. I appreciate that.
Should we end here? Sounds good.
Yeah, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, so you know, as we said in the beginning, if you want to check out more of like the digital programming that's going on, you can check out the hashtag CanCaf. And I mean, this is a really cool interview. Like, I feel like Matt doesn't do very many interviews, so yeah, a fun one.
I can't believe that on the Canadian on the replacement Canadian fucking convention podcast, I talked about in a Canadian voice. That's really, in retrospect, poor taste. I'm sorry, Canadian listeners. I apologize for forcing CanCon in your face. I really enjoyed Mounties, though. I really, really like Mounties.
Their crowning achievement, Mounties.
Okay. Yeah. You can find the podcast at Twitter, at twitter.com/saltandhoneypod. You can find me, Leslie, at Leslie Hung on Twitter and at Dairy Free on Instagram. And Sloan, you can plug yourself.
Yeah. I'm Sloan on Twitter, SloanSloan.com, Sloan Leong on Instagram.
That's Sloan with an E.
What?
It's Sloan with an E. People want to go follow the band Sloan. Another fun band.
No, I'm
more
the Sloan band. People know it's me. I'm more famous now.
You're more famous than Sloan.
Not in Canada. Now who's the one who's pissed off all of Canada? You just said that about Canada's own Sloan.
Fine. All the Sloans with an E. Okay, Matt. You plug now.
Me?
Matt first. Jordan. Matt
I'm Plug. Moving my house. I'm not on the internet, and I write comics, and one day we'll be out in the world and you can find those comics and buy them. Right now I'm writing Jimmy Olsen and November and Sex Criminals and other stuff, but it feels weird plugging and pitching things. So whatever, it's there or it's not, however you want to spend your time. I'm like, just take care of yourself, take care of each other, wash your hands, all that good shit.
Yeah.
Listen to Sloan, the band and the cartoon writer.
Yeah, listen to our podcast, but also listen to Sloan.
Yeah.
And that's it.
If you're not sure, check out, no. The A-Sides rule is pretty great. Just go ahead and help yourself.
Nice.
Yay. Well, thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Yay.
Goodbye. All right.